Episode 53 of Cherokee Rewind here. I am Mick. Thanks for hanging out with us. We appreciate it. And of course, this time around, we're going to go with a coach, a guy that was a former assistant coach here with the Cherokee back in the day. Guy who played hockey at, I believe, Western Michigan collegiately, and also played in Toledo with the Toledo Storm of the ECHL. My goodness, this guy has done a little bit of everything. And I believe currently is the bench boss down in Bowling Green for the girls or the women's hockey team. This guy goes by the name of Mike Witten. And every now and then I call him Wit, just so you know. But hey, Mike, how are you this fine day, sir?
Oh, fantastic, Mick. Thank you for having me. That was a great introduction. Looking forward to spending some time with you this afternoon and kind of reminiscing and going down memory lane. So appreciate the opportunity, my friend.
You bet. Thank you. Not a problem at all. My pleasure is all mine. Let's first start here. First, you played in Western Michigan. What was it like going over to Kalamazoo to play? Well, first of all, let's start with the basics. I usually do that with most of these. And that is, how old were you when you first got on some skates?
I think I was 5 years old. I think back growing up in where I first started playing hockey was in Oshawa, Ontario, a town about a half hour east of Toronto. I think they kind of got us Canadians back in the early 70s by you have to register for hockey before kindergarten. So they kind of got us by the tail there. So yeah, so about 5 years old, I started playing.
Okay, so you were born and raised in Oshawa?
Actually, I was born and raised in Scarborough, which is in the eastern part of Toronto.
Yep.
Moved there when I was as a 5 year old, if you will.
Okay.
So yeah.
Good Canadian boy, eh? Anyhow.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but so you play out there as a kid. Who, what coaches do you remember as far as growing up playing?
You know, that's a great question, and it's very timely, and it's something he's actually works, I believe, in Windsor, and it was really interesting. On LinkedIn about a year and a half ago, Mick, that I saw a post from a guy, and I thought, oh my gosh, is that the David Gilbert that was my Pee Wee hockey coach in 1982? I played for an Oshawa minor hockey travel team, a double A team, back in the day. And what really impressed me and really, really struck a chord, even before I even thought about hockey as anything of anything, but he was the first coach that did a practice plan and posted it on the inside of the dressing room wall. And he gave us the timelines. He printed everything out, drew his own diagrams, and it really kind of showed me, or set the foundation of what preparation and planning for not only as a hockey player, but as a future coach would look like. So David Gilbert was by far the first one. And he gave me an opportunity. It was my first travel team, too.
Wow.
If you will, a double A. So, yeah, so it's amazing how you look back and you look at some coaches, and let's say you get good coaches. Maybe not so good coaches, but then there's a couple that really stand out and really set some sort of, you know, blazing trail for what you want to be. So, Dave Gilbert, great question. Thank you for asking that question.
Hey, no problem. Now, you know, you play hockey. Now, did you play travel throughout your secondary school years, like through high school and et cetera?
Yeah, you know, that's another. These are great questions. This is fantastic. I was just talking about my wife this the other day. My travels to play hockey were a little unique, a little different than most folks. For right or reason or whatever that is, the highest level of hockey I played up until junior was double A. I didn't have the opportunity or did not have the skill set, skating or whatever you wanted to play triple A hockey or conventional travel hockey, as we talk about here, how you travel all over the place.
Yep.
Obviously, growing up in Ontario, there was a higher population or more denser population of players where you didn't necessarily have to travel that far for, you know, conventional reasons like you do in the United States or Northwest Ohio or Detroit, where you could, heck, we had junior teams every 15, 20 minutes, you know, in three different leagues. So, but with that being said, I played double A hockey up until 18 years old.
Huh.
And, yeah, and then with that being said, I had some friends, and if you don't mind, continue on with this.
Yeah,
I
sure.
had some friends who I played with, and actually I played hockey for a team called Goulding Park Rangers, and some of my friends had older siblings that played quote-unquote for U.S. college hockey teams, and they played AAA hockey, and I'm like, what is that? And they said, what it is back in the day, it's still existent, that Canadian colleges do not offer athletic scholarships. And so a lot of the Canadian players, you know, chose not to go major junior, but choose to go to like a tier two junior A, which will allow them to remain amateurs and allow them to be eligible for American college scholarships.
Oh.
So, yeah, so, but it's funny, if I could pause there for a quick second, if I could digress, because I was actually looking forward and hoping this question would come up. When I played AA for Goulding Park, which is part of a Toronto team, I played in the 1988 Silver Stick National Championship final game of AA, in Port Huron, and we lost to Team Toledo.
Really?
And it was interesting, Mick. For all the little paraphernalia and stuff, I still have the program. And I remember a number of years ago, I went and looked back. I'm like, oh my goodness, I see Vargas, Mankowski, I see, you know, Ossenmach, all these names, like some guys that I've known now. Fast forward many years.
Oh, yeah.
And it just kind of, yeah. And it's funny. Doug Smalley played for the team, actually, that I lost to. And I've become obviously good friends with Doug Smalley over the years. But and we kind of reminisced a little bit about that. But long story short, that was my idea. And a lot of the folks, guys said, hey, if you want to go to the U.S. colleges, you know, you have to play junior hockey. And, you know, I made my way as a walk-on, if you will, to a junior hockey team in Markham, Ontario, which is a little north of Scarborough, and played there for a couple of years. And then with that being said, the team was going to fold, and a coach by the name of Stan Butler, who was went on to be a Canadian junior national coach and had a long role with the Brenton Battalion and North Bay Battalion in the OHL, recruited me to play junior hockey for him.
Okay.
And then from there on, he was good friends and networked, and that's where he networked with Ron Mason, Jerry York, Bill Wilkinson of Western Michigan, a bunch of Division One college coaches. And that's where I learned another great role of what not only you get the skill set, but networking your skill set with other folks. So I may have went off tangent there, Mick, for a second. So, but anyways, I kind of wanted to share the story that, you know, just because you don't play travel hockey, you know, you still stick with it, find a love for the game, and find your niche and network the heck out of yourself, because there's opportunities out there for many people. So anyways, I apologize if I kind of went on there for a second and you know, a little bit. So
Whit, I have a rule here. We go all over the place, so do not. If you want to change directions on a dime, feel free. You're in safe mode here, so no need to worry. Trust me, I'll stop you and I'll throw in an aside myself, so don't worry.
Perfect, I love it.
So now, how were you recruited to Western? I mean, you talked about, you know, that your coach networked with these folks, but who was it that did you reach out to them? Did they reach out to you?
Actually, so what? This is a true story. So sometimes we didn't have, like, you know, the sophisticated weight programs and so on and so forth in junior hockey Canada that you do have here and all the facilities. So we would go to actually the coach's house and we'd work out in the basement or the garage. And I remember vividly Stan Butler getting on the phone, calling coaches, saying and. He said Ron at one point, and I suspect it was Ron Mason with Michigan State at that point in time, and said, hey, Ron, I've got a 6'2", 6'3", 205 power forward. I know you've got a few folks graduating. You've got Kelly Harper, Michael Burkett, guys that played the previous year for the Wexford Raiders in the junior program that I played my final year in Toronto, and said, hey, if you don't scoot this guy up right away, somebody else will. And he advocated for his players left, right, and center. And not only did he do that, he would actually schedule college visits to different colleges. And we did visits down the Bowling Green, Miami, Clarkston, St. Lawrence, Michigan State, and he would advertise the heck out of his players to promote them on forward. So, and so when he does that, of course, then the college coaches, if there was a level of interest, and back then there was no internet, you know, there was no cell phones. It was snail mail and faxing.
Yep.
So, you know, and phone calls. And so with that being said, the college coaches would come up and scout us and then do their due diligence and recruiting and form relationships. And, I had a few college coaches that were interested in me in my final year, the previous 2 years, nothing, if you will. And so that's how it happened. They watched me, and then there was an opportunity at Western to fill a role. And I guess the rest is Bronco history.
So you head into Kalamazoo, and you what was it like when you the first time you hit the ice and you saw all these guys that were there? Were you a little nervous? Any apprehension, or were you more excited to prove something?
Completely overwhelmed. Great question. Excited, nervous, fearful. It's amazing how those emotions are the best motivators in life sometimes. You know, feel of failure. I remember going out there, and then, you know, obviously you're playing with guys that are recruited and they're the best of their teams. Mm-hmm. My roommate at that point in time, that was assigned to me, his name was Ryan Darcy, and he played at University of Notre Dame out in Saskatchewan for the Hounds.
Yeah, I know that team very well.
So he played, and he broke a bunch of records, and he was phenomenal. And I looked at him like, and I said, my roommate at that point in time, Mick, night and day different. So I remember hitting the ice and during captain's practice, and, you know, guys like names that some people may know from the area, Pat Furschweiler, he was assistant coach at Detroit Red Wings under Jeff Blashill. He's out there flying around from Rochester, Minnesota. A bunch of other guys, actually another local guy in Ottawa Hills, Andy Suey, was a senior at Western when I was a freshman. I was a little later getting in there,
Yeah, he also played for the teammates. Storm too, right?
Right, so we kind of rekindled a little bit, and we play a little old man hockey, if you will, during the season at Ottawa Park when weather permits. So we always talk about the good old days with that. But another player who I end up becoming pretty good friends with and stallmates was Keith Jones, as just some people may be familiar with from NBC Sports during the halftime and, you know, the intermission segments with Catherine Tappan. So. Jonesy and I, I sat beside him, and let me tell you, you asked me about fear and intimidation and stuff. I didn't think I said a word to him for the longest time. I just listened, hear what he had to say, and so forth. And it was just a great education. And it was funny, you can imagine this. My roommate, we're doing captain skates, and obviously there's no contact, guys are just skating. And it's like the fastest shinny I've ever had in my life. Like, it was the fastest, you know, little. And, I said to my roommate at the point in time, I said, I think I'm so overwhelmed here. My game is more of a power game, if you will, a physical game. And he goes, well, you know what? Go accidentally run somebody out there. You know, find somebody that, you know, you won't, if he wants to drop the mitts to you won't lose a fight to a practice. Just go do that. I'm like, all right, I'll go ahead and try that. So I did it a couple times, and wasn't a big fan of the seniors and juniors, Mick, but I tell you, it gave me some credibility, and they knew kind of for the player I was, and it allowed me to kind of adapt myself to the college right away. So everybody has a different role in a team, and I played that physical role, but it was a lot of fun. Lots of fear, a lot of motivation, and just a heck of an experience. It was the greatest 4 years of my hockey career. It really was.
Do you remember your first game in a Bronco uniform?
I do. Vividly.
Who'd you play? Sorry? Go ahead. Well, who'd you play?
Yeah, we had a road game. We played the University of Illinois Chicago Flames, the UIC in the pavilion. And actually, that was the former college of another former Seattle Storm player Rick Jensen played there. So Juddy played there before I was there. But I remember playing in that rink. They only lasted, I think, in the CCHA. That was the league we played in for a couple of years. But my first game, and trust me, I was not a big point goal guy. I was actually an assist, speaking of the devil, if you will. I drew the puck back to, as I played center my first year, to Andy Sue, and he scored off the point. So, and he wasn't much of a goal scorer, too. So if Sue's listening right now, he's probably getting a chuckle on this. But, yeah, it was my first game, and it was very, very interesting. It was exciting. It was fast, and I was in Chicago. It was great. It was awesome.
Best of all worlds. Now, do you remember your first goal?
My first, yes. I believe my first goal, let's see, was that that night? Yeah, I believe so. So we played on, as many people know, that college hockey is played on Fridays and Saturdays, and sometimes depending upon weather or whatever that is, you play a very, very rare weeknight game. Mm-hmm. And it was a Tuesday or a Thursday. I think it was a Tuesday. We played Ferris State at home on a Tuesday night, and we ended up beating them, I think, 4-2, maybe 5. I don't know the exact score because I was really overwhelmed, to be honest with you, because I scored not only my first, but I scored my first 3 goals in that night.
Wow.
And it was interesting. It's like, I think I got 6 that year. and so I think maybe 6 that year. And it's interesting because when that happened, it's like, the school newspaper, the Western Herald, they made an article, natural hat trick. And I'm like, guys, what's a natural hat trick? I need to remember, what is that again? It's when one player from one team scores 3 goals in a row, uncontested by the other team or their own team, or something to that effect. I should probably know that better. But at any rate,
that's it.
And they're like, I'm like, oh, please. Knowing that the next, 27 games, I got 3 more. It was a pretty good accomplishment for a freshman. And, so it was all on one night. So it was quite the 15 minutes of fame that I got. So
that's great. Now, when you were at Western, was the team successful in terms of wins and losses?
Yeah, we competed very well. The first 2 years, we struggled. We had a good level of talent in the seniors, and then toward my junior year, I think we did the best. I think in 94-95, we competed in the national championships. Back then, they invited, I think, 17 teams, and we ended up going out to Albany, New York, and playing out there. And we were a top 10 for a short bit team in the country. So the first 2 years we weren't maybe on a national scale, but the last 2 years we did pretty well. We had some really good talented freshmen and sophomores that came into the program. So we were always very competitive. In a league back then where you competed against, or you had the Michigans, the Michigan States, and even small schools that are overlooked now that were powerhouses back in the Lake Superior States with an enrollment of 2,000 students. They were very, very good. So we were always middle of the pack, very competitive. Heck, even back then, Notre Dame as an independent just getting into college hockey, they were very competitive at all, but obviously it didn't take long for them to turn their program around. So yeah, I thought we did it very well for ourselves back in the early 90s.
So now you finished playing at Western, and did you at any point think that you were done there, or you were done competitively, or were you looking aggressively to catch on somewhere?
It's a great question. So going back into my career playing double-A hockey, a lot of people at that age, 17 years, even before that had a pathway or trajectory for hockey, they were getting drafted into the major juniors, the OHLs, the WHLs at 16, 17, if you will. Because I didn't play travel hockey, I wasn't even on that radar. So just getting into junior hockey was one of those things like, okay, identified an opportunity, a role to play. I played that role and was relatively successful. Same thing for college. When players were 18, 17, 18, or whatever, they're going to play college Division One, Division Two, or whatever that looks like. They were eligible for the NHL draft. You know, I was not even in consideration of that because of my the late age that I went to college. And so I remember, it's funny, great question again. I was in the penalty box at Lake Superior State with like 3 minutes left in the game. Don't know why, probably something alone, and I probably did something not responsible. But I remember looking at the clock going, I think my hockey career is done. I think it's done. And I'm just going to sit back and just look around, absorb this, and say, you know, I've got a college degree. You know, it's been, I beat the odds. This is very successful. And so, you know, at the end of the day, went back home, you know, back to campus, collected thoughts. And Bill Wilkinson, my coach at that point in time, had relationships like a lot of college do with professional teams. And essentially, with Pat Quinn of the Vancouver Canucks and said, hey, Mike, I'm not sure what you want to do. I know you're undrafted. You don't have a professional contract, but the Syracuse Crunch in the American Hockey League, that's your inaugural season back in 1995, they're not sure if they're going to make the playoffs or not, but a lot of their players were just called up to the Vancouver Canucks. They're short. Would you be interested in going to Syracuse for a short time? And I'm like, oh my gosh, a third time resurrection, I guess, in my career. I'm like, yeah, so I worked out with my professors at Western to do my exams a little different, you know, do a little later. Left school because now I'm an amateur. I feel I'm a professional, obviously, and that I would not lose my amateur status. And sure enough, I went to Syracuse and had a few cups of coffee in the American Hockey League. And it was a lot of fun. Played four games there. Was up there for a couple of weeks. Didn't make the playoffs. Came back to Western. Wrote my exams, and then I thought I was going to call it a day. Well, scouts and people kind of took notice that that's what you were doing, and got a call from Toledo, from a few other places, and they said, hey, we want to see if you want to come to training camp. And I'm thinking, I got a degree, I'm still in relatively good shape. I still have a kind of a burning for the game to develop and get better. Let me give myself a 3-4 year plan, to develop, and who knows where this will take me. And so that's kind of, to answer your question, after Western, that was kind of the thought process. If there was opportunity, I was going to grab it by the horns and go with it and see what happens and make the best of it.
So
that's how I got to Toledo.
I was going to say, you said you had other opportunities or other folks that were looking at you. Why Toledo?
So, interesting enough, I had Columbus, I had, ECHL teams, Erie, I actually had a couple Southern teams, and ironically, at that point in time, I met my future wife at Western, and she is from Toledo.
Okay.
And so, it was an ironic, world collision where Toledo called me and he expressed the most interest. I knew a bunch of guys because some of the guys from Bowling Green and Ferris State, end up going to Toledo. And we kind of keep that network, even though you didn't have a large, social media. I don't think social media was even existed in '95, if you will. So you had some sort of network that we all had calling cards, I think. And you'd mm-hmm. Hey, where you going? Where you doing? What you doing? And so we'd all talk. And then obviously my wife, my future wife was from here. I had some familiarity from visiting, and I thought, being an hour away from the border, and growing up in Toronto, it's only 5 hours away. My parents are like, "You're living in Toledo?" I said, "Yeah, I could be living in San Diego. I could be living in Dallas." I go, "I'm not too far away from home." So
right.
Geography from home, familiarity of the space in the city of Toledo, and just the networking and the guys that I knew that were going to be playing for Toledo were the reasons why I ended up playing and picking, and obviously they wanted me to, so playing for the Storm from back in '95.
But of course, meeting the woman that you fell in love with probably didn't hurt either.
Yeah, it was a great player, but the best part is that her family had no idea about hockey. It was funny. It's like she always would say something to the fact that she goes, "It's amazing. I never heard about hockey growing up at all," and I'd be invited over for like a dinner or something, and my father-in-law would she would say, he must have read the paper, must have done some homework, because she was asking really good questions. I go, yeah, I was really surprised. Like, I was actually quite impressed. And, well, mother-in-law, yeah, stepmother-in-law too, they were both like, boy, they wouldn't watch it. Like, he plays pretty physical. Is he? And what's he like off the ice? And it's like, you know, everybody's got a role to play, and you know, everybody's a little different based on what they need to do. So yeah, it was kind of fun to talk about it back in the day.
Okay, so you end up coming to Toledo, playing for the Toledo Storm. Aside from wearing a jersey with the ugliest logo in all of minor league hockey, what was it like playing back then? Obviously, I mean, because the folks at the NHL level, I can remember watching it on television. They always thought of the ECHL as more of a beer league, like a lot of fights and that's it. And it's like, I'm like, not so much. I mean, yeah, it's physical and yeah, you got your share of scraps, but there was some really exciting, entertaining hockey going on down there at One Main Street.
Oh, no question. It's amazing. Like I said, when people would go other places, and I had friends play in Raleigh, East Coast League, down in Louisville, South Carolina, you Peoria, you name it. People went everywhere, and when you'd reconnect, and they would say, you know, what's it like to play in Toledo? We hear that place, it is a zoo or a barn. I said, well, first and foremost, I go, the rink, if I remember the dimensions, was like 180 feet long by 80 feet wide. And for those that are listening, standardized NHL rinks are 200 feet long by 85 feet wide. So there was a lot less square footage to play in. But so you think of you fast forward and you think of the people that, you know, with USA Hockey developing the ADM model for small spaces and stuff. If you had to have, you talk about the Ian Duncans, the Dennis Purdy's, I can go down the list of guys who played hockey there that were Judsons, you know, that were very, very skilled in my era. You know, be able to play and operate in those tight spaces. And trust me, when you played in Toledo with that small rank, the other teams, they were bringing their finesse game. they were bringing their heavy, you know, the heavier players, more physical. Because they knew that they wanted to take away time and space, and so the skill set for the players in the Storm, not everybody. I played at a 6'2", 6'3", 215, 220. We had a bunch of handfuls of those, but we also had an equal balance of, you know, faster, maybe smaller players that were more skilled that would complement the team perspective. And that's why the team was very successful in the early 90s for Riley Cups and so forth. So the game itself, you're right, Nick, it wasn't a beer league. It wasn't, it wasn't like that at all. But let me tell you, there are some of the toughest, most dedicated players that I've ever played with. And the crazy thing is, sometimes the jokes were that the fans were even tougher and more dedicated than the players, because it's like you didn't want to disappoint them. The bench is obviously, for people that are familiar, there wasn't like boards behind us at all. There were, you know, there were just
fans,
open areas, fans. And if Mike Whitten wasn't doing what he thought, I heard it like within 3 inches away. So it's like the accountability from your fans and the diehards were second to none. So it was a great, hockey was great. The environment was second to none. And it was just a great experience that playing in there. And of course, you know, there was some tussle ups and some, you know, chilies here and there, but fans loved it. But you know what? To be successful, you got to put pucks in the net too. And that's what this team did a lot of as well.
Yeah, and it's funny because I remember as a kid going to that rink, going to that barn, and it was like, I mean, I went there when the Hornets played, I went there when the Gold Diggers played. My gosh, back then they always had 10-cent beer night, but when you saw the product on the ice, you knew why, especially the Hornets. But they were horrible. But I mean, at that point. But then when the Gold Diggers came in. It was in the 70s heyday, back in the era of Slapshot the movie, that kind of stuff. And it was very physical, very chippy, but there was also still some really good goal scores and some skilled play going on down there in the green and gold era. And Toledo was very successful back then, winning a number of Turner Cups. And then, of course, when they came back after hockey went away for a couple seasons and came back, the winning those Riley Cups, or Kelly, well, they're Kelly now, but back then they were Riley, winning those Riley Cups really brought the fiery passion back for the Toledo fan base for hockey. And not, the 90s were very much a real love affair with the Storm. I really believe that. I mean, people remember, especially the first 10 years, 10, 15, 12 years, people remember the names of those guys like it was nothing. Obviously, you know, guys like Dunk, whether it was him, Chief, you know, Greg Pahulski, of course, Chris McSorley, Ron Aubrey, of course, the pugilists were always the most popular, whether it was Ken Tasker, Ron Aubrey, all those guys. And then, of course, you got this other guy around that was, he was tough as nails and went by the name of Witten. And there were guys that everyone remembers because they played physical, they played with passion, and you can't BS fans. That's what happened to, I think, a little bit with the Goldiggers near the end, was that, you could play good, you could play well, but the crowd, you couldn't fool the crowd with what you were trying to do. And I mean, they did everything from bringing in the commissioner of the IHL to be the coach to all this other stuff. And it's like, these guys, they knew what they wanted, and they didn't always get it. And I think that with the Storm, they understood that the fan base, whether it was Barry Soskin with running the team, I think he kind of understood the Toledo fan market. I think that, the fact that he got guys in there that were passionate, that had a real fire for the game. And I think that it showed on the ice. And especially, like I said, the Storm, they had the ugliest logos, but by God, they were they had the probably the most popular teams. And that's why other teams were nervous. I won't say afraid or scared, but apprehensive. I'll be nice. Apprehensive about coming into the sports arena, because when you went into TSA, you knew you had to bring your lunch pail and your helmet. You're going to have to put in a full night's work if you wanted to get out of there alive. And that, half of that was the players, but the other half was how fanatically rabid the fans were.
Totally, Mick. You know, it's funny. I was just going in the list of just stories that I've been conjuring up that I've actually forgotten about the fans and the team and the makeup. And I it just kind of dawned on me. We played one time, I think we were very short bench. I think we had some call-ups to the American League or injuries, whatever. And I think we had four or five guys on the bench, maybe six. And at one point in time, Chief suited up and played with us. And I think at that point in time, we were in Johnstown, and it's funny because we suited up, and it's like we all look at each other. I'm like, I guess Chief's going to be on the power play for the most time. You know, we got like this still after. And I think the ECHL at that point changed their governing rules that a head coach at that point in time, before you, and not even a player coach, can dress up. But that was just one quick memory I was just brought up while you're talking. But you're right, the fan base, the buses they would take down. A lot of the similarities of the cities and the stories are like slap shot oriented. You know, they're just the diehards. There was an establishment that we go out to across the hall, or across the street, down the way, the Consult Tavern, for lunch. You know, and then we talked there, had our rookie parties there, and just different things. Like, and it's interesting for those that know in the hockey community, or back in the day in the 70s, the Philadelphia Flyers, they went through they had a nickname called the Broad Street Bullies. And there were stories that would be told, for years, that visiting teams, because they had a very tough team, with the Schultz and Billy Barber and all those guys, and that visiting teams would come into Philly and you look at the roster, I'm like, where is everybody? And everybody kind of had the Philly flu. They had the sniffles that game, and they couldn't make it. It was very, we hear stories that was very, very true of Toledo, that when people would come into Toledo, Well, because of the, you know, when you came into Toledo, you knew that you're going to have a, you're going to have a competition. You know, it's going to be tough. It's going to be skilled, and you know, you're going to get if you're not ready to be able to take care of yourself and your teammates, you know, that's it's in that fashion, watch out. So yeah, the stories I heard after the fact, like, it was so hard playing you guys were all like monsters, but you always beat us like 5-2, 5-3, and I'm like, you know what, recruiting good talent, people wanted to play here, blue collar town across the river, if you will, and which also attracted folks from the, you know, the west side of the river, and it was just a great combination of fans to play for. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
a lot of fun.
I agree completely. Because those folks, they invested their emotions in you guys. I mean, they really did. They grew emotionally attached to a lot of the players that were here, and I think that's part of the reason, you know, why some players still remained in the community after they hung them up. You know,
no question. And Nick, we talk about that all the time when we get together. Like, whether it's some of us skate at Thursday nights at Ottawa Park. Whether it's you know Sully and I talking, Juddy, you know, Perillo when he's not doing his I can say this is 7,000 hockey camps he does. Boother, you know, all those guys. Or even Teske when he has opportunity. We talk about. You know, like, you stay in town, you stay in the roots. Everybody's got different motivational factors of why they're here. But it's amazing. You do these alumni things, and or you walk around, and you know, and somebody will look at you that maybe is not 100% familiar, but maybe they are. And they're like, you look really, really familiar. And you know, it's like you kind of go, well, you know, you don't disclose. You're like, you hope that they say something first. But you know, most times it's you know how fortunate we were to play here and in front of these fans, and it's amazing. Like I said, they so this day, some of these people will, you know, some of these fans will say, like, you know, do you remember that game? And you're trying to be a little cloudy, but they remember things to a dime. They remember, you know, what the score was, what the weather was like. It was very sensible moments when, you know, these things that they remember, and it makes you look and reflect back and see how fortunate we were to play here. Really is.
And again, it just reflects on how much you meant to them that they remember those things like that. Now,
yeah.
Now, how long did you play in Toledo?
I played 2 years, 95 to 97.
Okay. And where did you go after 97?
90, so that's my next year would be my final year. Like I said before, 3 to 4 years I was giving myself. So I heard friends that would play down south, because I mentioned before, South Carolina. We did some roadie trips down in the down south, and actually a couple of ex-teammates, Purdy and Stitt, went down to play in San Diego for the Gulls. And you hear kind of little, hear remnants of it, boy, it's amazing down there, southern weather, blah, blah, blah. So the West Coast Hockey League was doing an expansion model, and the Tucson Gila Monsters was doing an inaugural season. So I signed a quote-unquote free agency to play for Tucson. So played for Tucson I played for three teams that year. Tucson had financial difficulties, and I ended up getting a traded / sold to Bakersfield, and then Bakersfield, the Bakersfield Fog, back in the day, mm-hmm. And I was there for I was in Tucson for probably about 2 months, and then I was in Bakersfield for about a month and a half, 2 months, and then just, you know, people get moved around in the minors for reasons sometimes you don't know. And then I ended up playing in Amarillo for the Rattlers in the Western Professional Hockey League.
The Whipple. So, the good old Whipple. So you go to Amarillo, and is that where you finished it all there?
That's when I finished it all. And it was a great experience. I knew it was at the end of my term, if you were playing hockey, and I looked at my age, and you know, I was in mid to late 20s and college degree, knowing, you know, I'm going to be competing with maybe 22, 23 year olds, if you will, as an entry level jobs in the workforce for in sales and marketing, which I got my degree in at Western. I thought, you know, I don't want to age myself of opportunity in retirement as the years goes on. So I decided at that age to call it a day and say I've been one of the most fortunate guys to play the game undrafted, untravel hockey, and meet a ton of great people, seen a lot of great things on, you know, hockey, you know, budget's dime, if you will, and be able to travel the country and do this for 3 or 4 years, you know. It was great.
Now, was there any difficulty for you as far as making the transition to life after competitive hockey?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. You know, it's interesting. You ask people, you know, how do I say it? I'm thinking, you know, if I experienced a more grander career 10, 15 years in the NHL, and they've established this and that, and there's different types of lifestyle luxury, I think that'd be make it more difficult. But knowing that how fortunate I was to get where I got to, and looking at what life was like, and for me, I thought I exceeded all my own personal expectations, and I guaranteed others that, you know, didn't think so. When I decided it was time, I looked back, and actually it was like, you know what? It was a relief. It was a relief that this was done. Obviously, the time commitment in the ECHL is the same as you would be in the American League, or maybe not as much in the American League and or at that point in time, the NHL, but just the commitment levels of staying in shape, lifestyle, the uncertainty of where you can be playing. And because I played for three teams my last year and basically I got bounced around, I said, you know, this is good. This is great. You know, let's just take a pause and let's move on to the next chapter of my life.
Hey, so. Fair enough. Now, of course, the next chapter, it led into you going into another phase where you didn't totally give up hockey. And that is in terms of coaching. How did you get started with that?
Yeah, so it's interestingly enough, and I'll digress for a quick second. So, as you mentioned earlier on, I'm now the head coach of the women's club hockey program at Bowling Green. And I was sharing with the girls not too long ago, like my team, there because they want to know a little bit of my background. I said, actually, I got my first coaching degree or certification, excuse me, in 1988 in Ontario for Ontario High School Hockey, where I coached our women's varsity at my high school at Woburn Collegiate. So I started coaching in 88, and then, of course, throughout the travels at Western and Toledo, summer jobs of doing power skating schools and hockey schools at the Storm here with Greg Pahalski for a couple of years. I've always wanted to, I like to teach, and I wanted to give back, and it's something I was very interested in doing. And then at that point in time, when I stopped playing in like 98-ish, mm-hmm. I think I got connected to the Toledo Cherokee program from their former coach, Scott Searing, because he played hockey at Ohio State, and then he introduced me to Todd Omi at that point in time, who I think was undergoing his first year or second year. Again, a little fuzzy, I apologize, late 90s there, if you will. And he asked me if I was interested in helping out with the team.
Yeah, I think it was 99-2000.
I'm sure you're spot on. So the next year, I accepted a role, working with, and obviously great people with Dr. Rod McCarthy, Chuck LeVay, Mike and Diana Robertson, you know, those folks there, Todd Omi, let's see, obviously, of course, yourself, Kirk Ludwig was assistant coach.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a bunch of great people, and you know, was behind the bench in an assistant, you know, supporting role, and it was great. The kids, the players are awesome, lots of fun. But yeah, I can go down the list of all, but most of the kids, and remember a cool story about all of them. So it was a great experience to kind of get back into something I really enjoyed.
Now, when you were there, I did a POTS or a podcast earlier with Ryan Potts, and Potsy was telling me that he goes, Witten, man, I tell you what, he was tough as nails, but he helped mold me. He said, because I just wanted to just, you know, hang around the net and that was it. He said, between him and later on, AJ Rufo, He said he was a guy that also, helped. And I just, I told him, I said, the thing I remember most about AJ, I said, was the fact that when we'd go on road trips, I said, Omi would try to razz me into stuff. I said, but AJ used to try to get me in trouble. And it usually involved shots of El Toro. But, I mean,
that's fantastic.
He used to do stuff like that. And I'm like, you know, if you're going to get me in trouble with this kind of stuff, the least you can do is get me some top shelf.
Exactly. Get off the wall a little bit. But,
yeah,
well, it was, as you know, there's a gazillion. And that was very kind of Potsy to say, and, you know, because the idea is that, you know, every coach had a different role, and mine was more of a tactical role, and, you know, and more of a, you know, maybe a strategic role. I'm not saying that obviously, you know, Ohms or Luddy had, you know, different roles, but, everybody, and I think this is something that I bring to the table in coaching. You take a look at players, maybe because I wasn't, the best skill, the best skater, but there's intangibles that you recognize in players, and how you develop and get players better is taking a look at their gaps, whether it's Potsy, you just mentioned Potsy in front of the net, you know, working on the back end a little bit, positively challenging these players to get better, and then having them see the wider picture of how that's going to benefit the team in the long run. And so I know you go down the list, and I'm sure I wasn't many of those kids, you know, those guys, or a few of those kids' favorite coaches. But it's funny, like, you know, Pete Darlis, like, on Facebook or whatever, like, he always wishes you a happy birthday. We always exchange things. And I see some of his stuff he does in his practices and his mentality. The kid's solid goal, you know, and a bunch of other guys. So I pushed him to think differently, too, and to be better. And hopefully they took something from them, because I think the best thing a coach can do is make your mark with a player that, you know, maybe you weren't their best friend, maybe you weren't the nicest, but you know what? You're honest, and the great players, you know, like Nick Saban may have said not too long ago, the players who are great, they want to be told the truth. And so, you know, and so when you see the players that want to be better and you recognize that, you tell them the truth, and sometimes the truth, it doesn't come comfortably. But you know, it comes respectively as long as it's delivered in a very honest way. And Potsy and all those guys took it all the time very honestly, which is why it was a great experience for me.
You know, and the funny part is that you know, I think it was him and I back in his podcast, Dotus also, both were like, you know, you don't recognize it when you're there, but you give it about 10 years and you'll realize what your coaches were trying to do, and then that's when you'll appreciate it more. He says, then you'll understand, you know, and that's a very true statement and a mature statement from these young kids and stuff. But, you know, I like I said, I and the other thing, too, I remember back then, too, I remember you telling me in an interview during one of our broadcasts of a game in between periods, you said something to me that that it kind of stuck with me. Obviously, I remember it all these years later. The idea that you try to win every single one of your home games in this league. And then you said you try to win at least 50% of your road games. So if you can split on your two game series and on the road, he said, that's 75% of your season. He said, and if you can do that consistently, that's going to get you into the playoffs. And you know, you just, you have to, you know, when you break the numbers down, that's going to get you into the playoffs. And then from there, it's all up in the air from there. It's what the work you put in is what you're going to get out of it. And, you know, for some reason that just stuck with me, with you. And it's funny because I just remember, you know, you were probably one of the more, not like, ah, ha, 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 point a finger, funny, fall down, funny guys, but you were one of the funniest by being, more, I don't know, I guess, you knew how to chirp, like, unlike anyone else I knew.
Well, I appreciate it. Sorry, go on. I'm just listening. I'm actually chuckling inside deeply, very deeply, but go on.
No, I'm just thinking, you know, I'm like, that was and that's what made that era so much fun. I mean, Omi was Omi, and he never changed, and that's why we all love him. And he, I mean, just a great guy and a good, very good coach. And same thing with Luddy. Luddy was just a riot. And I used to razz Luddy really bad because he was the one that did most of the intermission interviews with me from the coaching standpoint.
Yeah.
And the reason was because, and I told him right to his face that he would laugh. We'd laugh about it. But I didn't have to say anything. I would sit there and literally I'd say, Luddy, that was an interesting period. It was a tough period. And then I'd put the microphone in his face and I'd have to switch arms because the blood would run out and he would sit there and talk.
That's beautiful.
Oh my God. I mean, it'd be like, Luddy, the Zamboni finished cutting the ice.
Fantastic. Well, it's funny to comment on that. So Todd was really good.
Yep.
He was really, really good in the intermission. What he would do is guys would come in, if they had to use the restroom, whatever, they could take for a minute or two, and then he would say what he wanted to say or need to say, if he had some. And then what he would do, he'd go down the hierarchy, and I was like third man because I was last guy. And then what he would do is he would go to Luddy, and then, I would be the last guy, whether it's something I noticed technical, blah, blah, blah. Mick, to your point, many times, Luddy's talking, you hear the old, the whole thing, Luddy's off the ice, we gotta go. Todd's giving me the, I guess you're not getting last call, all right, boys, I'll talk to you on the bench. And Luddy's like, I'm sorry. It didn't happen all the time, but because you just mentioned that, boy, I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember that. To a T.
Yeah. Luddy is the only guy I know that could probably talk longer than it took to read War and Peace.
That reminds me. We were up in Flint one time, and if Luddy's listening, I'll make this family oriented. But we were at an establishment, and they had karaoke night, and we're looking around, and I wish I could remember everything like this back in the day, but. I remember looking at Omi, looking at me, going, and I think somebody else, do you want to do karaoke? I'm like, no. And we were like, let's sign up Luddy for karaoke. He loved to get up there. So we get, I think it was like, Hey Jude from the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
And we're like, Kirk Ludwig, he's like, oh my gosh. Oh. I'm like, oh, you guys, I'm going to get you guys. You gotta go. And you get to see Luddy up there going, Hey Jude, I'm not a singer by any stretch of the imagination, and we talked about that for years.
My God!
Even after the fact, going to your comment about the home games and the winning every other, those are targets. And if you take a look, if you're 750, that'll get you in the playoffs. Heck, you look at baseball batting champions. I'm not a big baseball guy. What is that? 350? 360, that may be high. I don't know. But, that's the, you think about that.
You get a batting title there.
Yeah. If you put the expectation that, we win every home game, this is our barn, there's no real reason why not to. And not to say that you're going to take every other night off on the road, but if you set that expectation and that goal in that segment, or those segments, that, hey, this is what we're going to do, and if you don't even get to 750, maybe you get to 650, 700, but in life, if you don't set goals and set expectations for your players or even kids or whatever it is to follow, then you don't have a model or business plan to actually follow. And that's something I learned on, and that's kind of how I always judge my success rate in the game of hockey.
Yeah.
I'm glad you remember that. I appreciate it. Yep. It's an honor. Thank you.
Yep, you bet. But it was true. I mean, that's when you pointed that out to me, I was like, that makes sense. It really makes sense. And it opened my eyes to a lot of things of what you guys do to get these guys prepared and to target, try and reach goals and achieve these things, not for yourselves, but for them, and that really, it opened my eyes to a lot of things that you guys do. And that's why I've always appreciated more and more, the work that you did, that Luddy did, Omi, Kinsey, I mean, all those guys, Vargs, Dunk, all of them, Tarsh, Dixie, there's just a whole bunch of them there. Bakes. I mean, there was all ton of them that were before and after that. I didn't realize just how hard they really work, and it really, like I said, it was an eye opener. So now, when Was there anything that really stuck out at you story-wise, in addition to the karaoke, from a, I guess, from a practical joke standpoint, did you ever notice anything amongst the kids, any of the silly stuff they did?
Now, first of all, I gotta remember some stuff which I was thinking about for this, and then secondly, I gotta be careful not to
I understand.
censor slash get people in trouble because you know,
Statue of limitations is
the best stories are the ones that you know are spoken behind closed doors, you know, and repeated, you know, sometimes. But no, you know, these guys were great kids. I think it was the era when they all, one of them I think remember when they all, I don't remember, they was it they all dyed their hair yellow or something
Blonde,
one
yeah.
time, blonde, and like. You see it sometimes on local swim teams as their initiation, you know. So those type of things. Let's see. I'm just trying to think of the road, you know, different stories they would tell on the road, and you know, it's
You know,
practice
when
stories, you know.
for rookie initiation, I remember, I think you were there. Were you there the year that Cole Herb played
Oh, you know,
from Fort Wayne?
I'm not sure, and I apologize for that. I'm not
No, the only
100%
reason I
sure.
ask is because I remember him. He shaved his head and dyed leopard spots in his hair.
That certainly sounds familiar. That certainly sounds
And it was
familiar.
right around, I mean, you were with the Cherokee how long? From.
What, a year, yeah,
Okay, then
a year and a
that
half,
may have been after you by a
or a year
year.
and a half, maybe a year, yeah, maybe even
Okay.
after me.
Okay. Well, still though, I mean, the fact remains is that the fun we had on the road, in addition to at home. But I mean, those are crazy. The I mean, you hear about stuff about kids, you know, the when they do things like they'll do leaners or you know shoe check, that kind of stuff, as practical jokes and stuff, or else they'll do stuff with the mattresses in their hotel rooms and you know the usual.
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys, when you coached, I'm sure you did a lot of fun stuff when you played, but when you coached, were you guys, did you guys ever fall victim to any of their stuff, or did you try pulling anything on them?
You know, we didn't do a lot. We left their creativity to a lot for themselves. I think for those that know Todd Omey. I think some more part. He best part about Todd Omey is the fact that, like I said, when he looked you in the eyes, he was telling you straight up, wrong, right, or indifferent. If you liked it or not, he's telling you the truth. And so, a lot of kids, what they really appreciated with Todd is that he would tell them the truth and he would have them grow. So, because of that, I think they're afraid. They're extremely afraid. So he didn't have to do anything to them because they're afraid if he did anything, it'd be like, uh-oh, I'm getting sent home with a garbage bag. So we kind of let the players do that for themselves. I think the players did some stuff with us that, you know, they would call like the hotel front desk and like, can we get a wake-up call to room 427 for 5 a.m.? And I'm like, and you're like, you hear this, obviously back in the day, this loud phone call. I'm like, who is calling me at 5 a.m.? And all of a sudden, you know, you hang up and like, I'm going to get them. And all of a sudden, 15 minutes later, another call. Like, and then the 5:30, I'm like, you son of a, I'm like, and you know what? They're thick as thieves and they would never tell you. Blah blah blah, or you know, like we had to out to dinner or something. They would. I think if I remember, they would like mix the sour cream for ranch or something. If you're
Oh,
at the Bob
jeez.
Evans, so we're all small stuff. Obviously, they're junior hockey players, so they weren't like doing like big budget type pranks like cutting ties when they're sleeping, you know, or anything like that. So, you know, it was just you know very small stuff like that, or. You know, getting your shoes all taped up on the bus and thrown out in a snowbank, you know, and you get out so you couldn't get off the bus. So just stuff like that. Nothing. And of course, the stuff they did with each other, you know, the rookie stuff, they didn't tell us, or I wasn't privileged to hear what they disclosed others. So
Oh my, that's
yeah,
funny. So
and
now,
that's the best part about it. Sometimes you keep it to yourself, and that's the protection of the locker room. you know?
That's true. That's true. And it also helps build loyalty, you know?
Absolutely. No question.
You know, and now, so you are in Toledo. What caused you to move on and get to where you are now?
In terms of hockey?
Yes.
Yeah. So for a number of years, my daughter started playing for small in the house league program in, gosh, 2002. Sorry, I just lost my headphone for a second. I apologize. Let's see. Oops. Can you hear me?
Yep, we're fine, buddy. We're
apology
fine.
For technical. Yeah, so I coached her back meeting in 2002, I believe, 2002, 2003, just in the house league program for a few years. And then my son was born, and then he ended up playing. So I was kind of involved with her playing at Gataha over there, coaching the girls program there for a couple of years. And then he would be, then he started playing hockey for a few years, and then I ended up coaching the Sylvania North Stars AA program for a few years. And then my daughter ended up stopping playing, I think just because of the lack of females and lack of, you know, competition around the area. And she was looking to go into other things. She was going through, you know, junior high or high school and going to tennis and swimming. So she wanted to kind of stop playing there. My son kept on playing, and then played actually a JV for St. John's in his freshman year. And at that point in time, he was playing travel lacrosse. And he came up to me one day and said, "Hey, Dad, you know, you okay if I stop playing? Stop playing hockey." And I said, "That's not a problem." And this was the year, this freshman year, where I didn't do anything in terms of coaching. I was just, you know, hockey dad.
Yeah.
And then, you know, which was great. And then two years later, as of last year, if you will, and I apologize if I'm kind of going fast and jumping through the years, a teacher at St. John's who was the head coach for the JV team, Dana Rowemaker, she worked with the varsity program at St. John's. She was also coaching like two other like North Star hockey programs here in Sylvania, but she was also working with Bowling Green to start up a renewed club women's program there. And in terms of, you know, she was actually interested in me helping her out at St. John's. And she said, "Hey, would you mind kind of, now my schedule sometimes is kind of tight. I know you're not coaching, and would you mind doing so?" And kind of funny side note, Mick, political move. She was also my son, Blaze's, calc teacher at St. John's.
Oh, beautiful.
So I think if the calc teacher's asking me to help, and my son, who is actually a very smart kid and a very good student, like, you know what, this could be a good move. So
yeah,
last
right.
year I helped her out, and where we had just, you know, a handful, six, seven players, and then she eventually got recruited for a high school in Minnesota, and ended up moving to Minnesota to lead a women's program of 35 women in high school and be I think a department head in mathematics out in Minnesota. And so natural progression would be like, okay, my two kids, one's at UT, one's at Miami right now as a freshman, which is my son, my daughter Sydney is at UT. I'm like, you know what? Kind of relatively empty nesters. I'm like, and I still want to stay in the game. The girls at Bowling Green, the ladies down there, it's a lot of fun. They're great gals. They work hard, really, really hard. And it's a joy to be around. And I said, you know what, I'll just naturally insert myself as the head coach. And so this year I took the head coaching job, if you will, and on a volunteer basis in the Bowling Green. Their club director, director of club sports, Bill Sweetie, who was a former Division I hockey coach at Kent State and part of the faculty at USA Hockey, obviously that's his current role, offered me the position to be the head coach for the 21-22 season. So with that being said, I'm back involved with the game of hockey. It's interesting that I went to Western, daughter goes to Toledo, you know, son goes to Miami, and I'm coaching a Bowling Green. It's like, it was like the Mac trifecta, whatever you want to hit for the cycle, if you will. So right now we're doing that. We've got nine skaters, one goalie, and actively recruiting. I've got 5 or 6 student athletes that are interested in attending Bowling Green next year to play women's club hockey. Obviously, I've got a couple that are graduating, and it's just a thrill for the fact that during COVID times, you know, many women's programs are suspended for the year, and we were able to have a game scheduled for this Sunday at 8:30. Unfortunately, it's like invite only due to COVID spectator regulations, where each team only has 50 spectators involved. But you know, some of these girls have practiced for 2 years, Nick, and have never played a college game with their school crest on their jersey.
Wow.
So it's a thrill for me to be partly responsible for this to happen. And it's, you know, the club sports of Bowling Green, a lot of it is student run. So I give them a lot of credit for sticking in. I guess can imagine practicing all the time. My practices aren't always easy. Twice a week for almost 2 years.
Yep.
Without a game. I give them all the credit in the world to be motivated, stick with it, and where it's at. So anyways, I didn't mean to digress there, but it's been a fantastic time being part of those ladies. It's been great.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a couple more things here before we finish up.
Sure.
If there was one piece of advice going through what you've been through from the time you were, as a young kid playing, to going through what you went through in college, the minors, and, coaching. What advice would you give to a junior player or a young college player? What advice would you give them based on what you've gone through and experienced?
Right, exactly. So my advice would be this. And taking a look, and that's a great question. I always talk about a team, and I've touched upon this during the course of our conversation today, is that you can't have every player be 6'3", 225 pound, and play one role. A team is like a puzzle. Every puzzle is different, which means every role is going to be different. Every piece of that puzzle is going to be colored differently. So it's really important to be a team or a successful team-minded person, where you are going to play a role, or you're going to identify with a role and be successful with it. And sometimes the roles that you're going to do may not, or you're going to commit to do, may not be the exact role that you want to do at that point in time. But you're thinking bigger picture, and you're thinking, how can I develop myself to be able to fill that piece of the puzzle to move forward? And how you do that is you need to pay attention to planning, practicing, getting better every day, and realizing that it's not only your play that dictates that, but it's also, more importantly, I think, your character and your attitude that allows you the first impression for a coach to allow you to fulfill that piece of the puzzle in that role. So to answer your question, Mick, it's kind of multifactorial, but it comes down to, you know, identifying opportunities, you know, networking in terms of what you're going to do to accomplish that, putting yourself in a position to be successful once you have that opportunity by working out, by mental preparation, by practicing. Once you do all those things, you know, success is a result of all those opportunities put together.
Now, is there anyone in particular you wanted to pattern yourself after when it came to coaching?
Let's see. You know, I not necessarily one person, if you will. I really liked, and what I really appreciated with was two gentlemen, actually three gentlemen. It's kind of a combination. You may remember earlier conversation, David Gilbert.
Yep.
When I was in Oshawa. So Dave Gilbert was one at 12 years old. In junior hockey, Stan Butler, who was my junior hockey coach at Wexford, he's another one. Dave Gilbert, obviously early on because of the preparation and the expectations for younger kids. Stan Butler, because for some reason, he was never going to lose. And the positive confidence that he exuded and the trust he had in his players was another thing. And then the third one would be, who's a head coach at Cornell for probably 24, 25 years, is Mike Schaefer. And Mike Schaefer, he would he would talk to me because, hey, Witt, if you really want to be a good hockey player, like, you got to have a relentless effort in the weight room, and this is what you got to do. And then he'd point to give you an example of somebody else. So he would use peer accountability, to develop me in his preparation and basically being truthfully honest and to players that want to get better and saying, hey, this is what you're good at, this is what you're not good at. You know, everybody at the level is good at everything, but if you want to get better or if you want to advance the next level, get extra special on one thing. And he would provide constant feedback on that. So to answer your question, it wasn't specifically one. It's parts of three, if you will. And I think all three together, kind of how I model my coaching philosophy and how I do things today.
Well, that bodes the question then. Do you think maybe someday you'd like to coach at a higher level?
You know, that's a great question. It was interesting, and if you have 2-3 minutes, I'll tell you a true story.
Go ahead, take your time.
Yeah, so in my one of my previous roles, I traveled in the state of Michigan, and I was in Grand Rapids. At that point in time, Jeff Blashill and Pat Furschweller were Blashill now obviously being with the Wings, but Blashill being a head coach of the Grand Rapids Griffins, and Pat Furschweller, next teammate, was assistant coach of the Grand Rapids Griffins. So every time I was in town, I said, hey, you want to stop by for coffee, drink, whatever, whatever you want to do. And so I said, yeah, I'm coming in town. So he goes, yeah, stop by. We have pregame skate. So literally, I go into Van Andel, and I'm dressed up because I got an appointment like in an hour or two. And I said, hey, I'm looking. Some guy said, hey, can I help you out? I said, yeah, I'm looking for a Pat Furschweller. And he said, oh, I think he's in a meeting. And literally, he walked to this room and knocked on the door and stuck his head. And he goes, hey, yeah, some guy here is looking for you, Patty. And I'm like, don't go in there. Don't interrupt. Yeah, whatever. And he said, who is it? And he goes, hey, what's your name? I told him, hey, my name is Mike Whitten. And they said, hey, Mike Whitten. And they said, yeah, they tell him to come on in. So I go into this room, Mick, and I look to the right. It's Jeff Blashill, okay, to sitting down, Pat Furschweiler, beside him, Chris Chelios, beside him,
holy cow.
Mike Knuble.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sitting here, and they're going through a pre-practice plan. And I'm like, and then the first is like, and then knew me pretty well. Back in the day, we're like stallmates after Jonesy left. And sitting down, and it was interesting. And I tell the story to the girls and some people that I coached in the past. Is that they're going through like these drills, and it's interesting. And like the same drills they're doing at the American Hockey League level, we do or we did through the North Stars, many of the same drills. And it's just, they just do it at a tighter concentrate. And I'm sitting back and I'm looking, okay, this is what they do for a living. This is what they do. And then and I share with the girls, I'm like, they start talking to the drills' names, and I'm like, and I say, hey, Witz, by the way, here we named the drills after the guys that somehow struggled to get them. So it's like this drill is like Smith drill or Brown drill. It's like, I'm like, I get it. I may pick up on that one for the future. But this is like maybe 10 years ago. But I sat back one time thinking, obviously, these guys, Nick, they've done their time in junior hockey. They've done their time, traveling around on buses more than probably – and that's the grind, is that they did their time and that work, and they developed their craft. And, at this point in time in my life, where I'm at, yeah. I would love to be able to do something like that. But, you have to build a body of work and have a network of things to be whatever the career could be. Who knows? Yeah, we'll have to be grandpa, maybe be a coach in the future. But right now with Bully reading the girls. But interesting. So anyways, I sat down and just listened to them all. And the coolest guys in the world. It was such a pleasure. I was kind of struck for a second. I was like, I expected maybe just, Jeff and Pat in the room, but like, no, they're going through this whole thing and talking about players and this and that. And just to be able to talk hockey at that level with four of those guys was quite an honor. And just, moving forward, it was, it was like, geez, I go, and of course I had practice that night and I incorporated one of those two drills, and sure enough, the kids that I had, they did it great. They did it great. But right now, to answer your question, the Bowling Green State University Women's Club team is just where I want to be, and nowhere else.
That's Hey, that can't ask for more than that. Okay, last question. Well, it's not so much a question, but Cherokee Nation, they listen into this pretty good, and I'm grateful for that. Is there anything in particular you want to say to the folks of Cherokee Nation here?
You know, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, having the opportunity to kind of seeing it, you know, having friends, you know, when you're a little older who've got kids that are going through the junior programs and stuff, you know, I can't thank the people behind the scenes, the billet families, the fans, the mix, if you will, you know, the trainers, the you know, the people who've got a vision to keep this the Millers, the Kennys, the all the coaches. That, you know, if you want to, or you have an opportunity where you have knowledge, or you want, you can give back, because a lot of these kids, you know, they're coming from California sometimes. Illinois, you name all over the place, you know. They want to continue their career, whether it's club hockey, whether it's D3, D1. You know, if there's an opportunity where you can support this team in any fashion, I'm guaranteeing you that the time you mentioned earlier on, it may not be reflected upon by the players and the kids at that point in time, but years down the road when they're kicking the can and doing other things, they look back and realizing, you know, it was a very fortunate time, and it's only fortunate based on the people who give their time and give their efforts, and whether it's fans and everybody I mentioned, to be able to do that. And so if you have an opportunity, if you can give them that, or just go watch a junior game, go online, take a look at, you know, Google Twiddle Cherokee Junior Hockey, find their schedule and support them. I'm telling you, it goes a lot longer than a long ways, and I think these kids and the organization certainly appreciate it. So I'm very thankful. It's been a great time, you know, that 1.5 years, and it was a great story. It was awesome.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, Mike, my gosh, I say this every time, but it's true. It only seemed like a few minutes, but we've been on here a while. So I appreciate it, man. This is that I've just enjoyed reconnecting with you, and I'm sure we will reconnect again, because that's the one thing about hockey. You know, it's like the folks involved, you may not talk to each other for a good long time, but when you do, it's like you'd pick up where you left off. You know, you just reconnect, and it's always a good time, because hockey is just that rare sport where it's not just the game, but because of the game, it affords you a lot of good things and friendships and relationships. And you talk about networking, but friendships and relationships, all those things come aboard when you talk about the game of hockey and what it can do for you. And this is one of them, and that's having you as a friend. And I appreciate that a ton, buddy. And now that I know how to get a hold of you, I'll probably have to go down when we're able to, when they allow us to go catch a BG women's game.
That's great, Mick. And it's been my pleasure entirely. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you reaching out. This is like, you're right. I look at my watch. It's like, oh my gosh, an hour and 17 minutes. Not too often can I talk an hour and 17 minutes in a month, let alone an afternoon on a Thursday.
Let alone, unless your name's Kirk Ludwig, right?
No, exactly. He's got to book him in every other day for 2 hours, I guess. So poor Luddy, he's here. He'd be loving it. No, but this has been a great trip down memory lane. It's been fantastic. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share my story and a little bit about me. And you know, Toledo's a great hockey town with a lot of different opportunities, from juniors to obviously to the Tamos to Bowling Green, University of Toledo Club Hockey. Everything. If just go out and support your local hockey if you can during these times. And I'm sure it's something that we all miss very much so.
Yeah.
This is great, Mick. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it most. It's episode 53 here of the Cherokee Rewind. Mike Witten, thank him so much. Don't forget, you can subscribe to any platform you use, whether it's iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Subscribe to Cherokee Rewind, and every time a new episode drops, it will notify you. So for Mike Witten, I am Mick. Thank you so much, and we'll catch you next time on the Cherokee Rewind.